Welcome to the Empathy Exchange podcast, the show dedicated to helping seniors care staff and residents' families build relational connections based on trust, respect, and understanding as partners in care. To work together in the shared goal of providing the best possible quality of life and care for people living in seniors care, your residents and loved ones. So if you work in seniors care or you're a family member, this podcast is for you. I'm your host, Deborah Bakhti. Welcome back to the Empathy Exchange podcast. And I have been looking forward to this interview with my guest today, Dr. Samantha Winemaker. Let me just share a brief bio to introduce you to my guest. Dr. Samantha Winemaker is an associate clinical professor, Department of Family Medicine in the Division of Palliative Care at McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario. She teaches palliative care to healthcare professionals, and she won the Ontario College of Family Physicians Award of Excellence in 2010, the Elizabeth J. Latimer Prize in Palliative Care in 2018, and the Dr. S. Lawrence Librach Award for Palliative Medicine in the Community in 2019. Dr. Sammy, as she's referred to, is the author with co-author Dr. Cien Siao of the book Hope for the Best, Plan for the Rest, Seven Keys for Navigating a Life-Changing Diagnosis. And she's a founder of The Waiting Room Revolution, and we're going to be talking about that. Welcome to the Empathy Exchange podcast, Dr. Sammy.
Oh, thanks for having me, Deb.
Well, I had just mentioned to you before we got on the call that I've finished reading your book and this Hope for the Best, Plan for the Rest. And what's interesting is when I first cracked it open and you were talking about a palliative patient with a condition that I had just discovered a family member of mine had been diagnosed with, and I'd never heard the diagnosis before. And that, along with having both my parents and my husband who all lived in seniors care, it really brought home for me, even though I worked in the seniors care industry, not as a clinician, I didn't really understand what palliative care was about and that difference between that and end of life. And I thought I'd like to start with that question because I'm sure our audience members who are people who work in seniors care and families have the same question. Can you share your definition and the difference between palliative care and end of life?
Sure. Okay. If you ask 1,000 people, you'll get 1,000 different answers here. I'll tell you that much. Palliative care, I would say, is the umbrella term that should span an entire illness course from the diagnosis till the end. And within palliative care, there are different chapters, and one of them is end of life care. So it used to be that people would associate palliative care with just end-of-life care, but we are modernizing the way people think about the word palliative care. Sometimes we refer to it now as a palliative approach, a philosophy of care that should be peppered throughout an entire illness journey. And it includes end-of-life care as well.
That's really helpful because what I find from my own experience and talking to other family members, as soon as they hear that P word, it creates an emotional reaction. And so thinking about families recently having moved a loved one into long-term care or assisted living memory care, and they have been placed there because of a, as you describe, a life-changing illness. What would you say to them? And I'm sure you've worked with families and patients that are in that situation. How do you broach the conversation to help educate them and bring them up to speed with what you've just described?
I think we're not there yet, to be honest with you, in long-term care. I think that, well, I know that palliative care is still a word that many people are allergic to. And so you will find two camps out there. One camp that says we should use the word and educate around the word and don't shy away from it. And other people who would say, you know what, it's a barrier because of the fears associated with it. So get rid of the word and let's just talk about the care that the person needs. So it really does depend from which camp you're coming at. As far as I'm concerned, I think in the background, we can talk about palliative care behind the scenes. I think that it's really important that public health takes a public health approach to the population feeling more comfortable with their own mortality and words like palliative care. But when you are dealing with a patient or a family that is in the middle of an illness journey, that word can be very scary and a barrier. So I actually never introduce myself in people's homes as a palliative care physician. I usually say I'm a physician, part of a home visiting team, and I'm part of your the rest of your team, and we're here to help you be the best that you can be. And in long-term care, how would that look? Well, I believe that from the very front door of long-term care, that we need to have open, honest conversations with patients, residents, and their families about what we expect during their stay in long-term care and the kind of commitment that we're going to make to making them the best that they can be while they're living in long-term care. But while in long-term care, there will be a changing horizon. The person is not going to stay exactly the same as they did when they came through the front door. And so those changes will be perceived as crises if we don't offer this kind of truthful, realistic communication right from the start. And I don't think we need to label it. I think we need to help people understand where they're at in their illness when they come into long-term care and what to expect as time goes on.
You did a podcast interview with Donna Duncan with OLTCA, and I forwarded that interview to a good friend of mine because her mom had just moved from retirement into hospice, I'm thinking it was. And she listened to that interview and it gave her the insight and the courage to speak to her mom's doctor and say, I just need you to tell me straight what's happening. What should we expect? And she wouldn't have had the awareness to ask that question. And she said the doctor almost took a step back and kind of went, oh, so you want to have that conversation. Like almost kind of made it a bit of a big deal. And she said that it was a matter of weeks after that her mom passed away. And it created, I mean, it's still obviously devastating, but it created a better level of peace and understanding that she had because of the insights that you shared, which also you talk about in your book. And I feel like this is the kind of information as families coming into long-term care need to read, whether it's imminent or like in my situation, my husband lived in long-term care for 4 years before passing away. But he was palliative for that entire time, or he was having a palliative experience or
a palliative approach.
And like you say, they're living in long-term care. They're not dying in long-term care.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, with respect to your friend who, you know, tried to invite those open discussions about what to expect, you know, that is our worry as we set the citizens, patients, and families, you know, forward with this new mojo of being more respectfully activated and knowing what they have a right to know. The anxiety we have is that they're still going to be met with a very uncomfortable system who aren't completely ready to engage in those discussions. So we have to do both. We have to empower patients and families to get what they need. And we have to continue to teach clinicians how to respond to people when they're asking for this kind of information. Their number one worry is that they're going to make people depressed and sad and give up and hopeless if they give them the truth. But in reality, information is power, and even information for better or worse helps patients and families plan and feel like they have better control. It's therapeutic for the patient and family, and for the healthcare provider, it feels better to be open and gently truthful, mm-hmm. Then shy away or, you know, excuse yourself from the conversation or say, oh, sorry, I don't have a crystal ball.
It reminds me of, it took us almost 2 years to get a diagnosis from my husband, and he had a very rare, degenerative, incurable disease. Mm-hmm. And I remember at one point, the lead rheumatologist who was leading this said to me, you're not going to believe me when I tell you this, but you will feel better once we give you a diagnosis, no matter what it is.
Yeah.
And I remember saying, it can't possibly be because if it's a worst case scenario. And when we did, and it was a worst case scenario, just what you're saying, we knew what we were dealing with, and then we could start putting a plan in place. But the not knowing, mm-hmm. I think, ends up creating some false hope.
Yeah. And, you know, we know from the research in psychology that people don't do well in limbo, that they would rather have sad, bad news and be able to react and adjust and move on than just remain suspended in limbo. You know, it's like when people are waiting for the results of a CAT scan or an ultrasound, and they have to wait and wait and wait for pathology results, or in your case, Deb, the final diagnosis, after probably months and months of this mysterious degenerative thing going on that no one could label. It's like paralyzes people.
Mm-hmm. I want to go back to a comment that you made that ties into a section in your book where you talk about the fear of being labeled difficult. Mm-hmm. And I just want to read this excerpt. One of the biggest challenges of inviting yourself is the fear of being labeled difficult and getting suboptimal care. While the potential of being labeled difficult might be hard to accept and it's not fair or appropriate, you should not be quieted by it either. And mm-hmm. you use a term which I love called being gently fierce. Mm-hmm. So what I wanted to talk about with that is where families, they take on the role of advocate, but sometimes it creates an adversarial versus an allied-like relationship. Mm-hmm. So would love your thoughts on that.
Yeah. So first, I was just going to say, I didn't make that up, gently fierce. That came from one of our amazing podcast guests who shared her story with us. But it's like you said, like we cannot avoid asking questions and coming forward in our illness journey with fear of being labeled difficult or problematic. It is important to, like you said, balance assertiveness with tact and respect. And I think there is a way to do it that doesn't always ruffle the feathers of the other one, that you're speaking to. Most physicians, I think, I can speak on behalf of physicians, they get all in a tizzy when people, I think, come at them in a more aggressive style. But you can be empowered and you can be assertive and you can be gently fierce when you seek information. And who cares what the doctor thinks? Really? Doctors don't change the kind of care a person gets based on whether or not they feel the patient and family is difficult or not. They shouldn't anyway. And if they do, then that is a real, you know, that's going against our, you know, code of ethics and the oath that we take in medical school. And I believe that if people come forward and say to their doctor, the reason why I'm asking you this is because da 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 da. If the doctor has the rationale behind it, and you, you go at the heart of the reason why you're asking the questions, I believe that most clinicians will try their hardest to answer the question.
Well, it lines up with another piece that I wanted to bring out in your book, because there's so many great pieces, as you can see all of the mark tabs that I have, is the knowing your style. Mm-hmm. And so in the work that I do with the family, staff, relationship, and long-term care, sometimes families can get labeled as difficult or mm-hmm. passionate or involved, like all those code words. Mm-hmm. And I push back to say, are they a difficult family or is it a difficult family relationship? Mm-hmm. Because of where the family member is coming from and their ability to cope. And you talk about in this knowing your style, and one of the quotes from the book is, their personality traits and coping mechanisms become more pronounced as the stress or uncertainty in the illness increases. Knowing this can help you avoid unnecessary frustration.
Yeah.
It's a simple but profound concept. When we're able to know ourselves and how we're typically going to react or respond when we're under stress with our own diagnosis or as a family member, what I'm getting from that is sharing that with people so that it doesn't seem like your behaviors are just coming out of the blue.
Yeah, it's very powerful. And that includes when you're dealing with the healthcare system, is to say, you know, I'm the kind of person who craves information. I don't do well when I feel I'm being kept out of the loop, even if it's difficult to hear kind of stuff. Please understand that the way I cope is to be really involved or whatever. It's like your terms of engagement or the things about you that you think will be helpful for the healthcare system or people in your family or your friends to understand so that they don't misread or get frustrated with you. And I would say that every time someone is labeled difficult or too activated, it's usually because they have felt ignored or, brushed over. That will amplify a person who craves more information. And so I would say that it's really the healthcare system's fault for not seeing the needs of that particular person. So I'm really excited when I go into someone's home and I'm in long-term care or hospice, and immediately I can see in the room who is that person. That person who is normally more activated, more asking more questions, writing things down, perhaps questioning alternatives, et cetera, et cetera. I say to myself, this is going to go well because we have an assertive person. It is easier to deal with patients and families who just are more passive, but those patients and families get really conveyor belt kind of care, just standard, go with the flow, cookie cutter kind of care. If a person really wants their loved one to get a very personal type of care journey, then either the patient or the family needs to be activated, because what they're trying to do is say, the standard here doesn't work for my person. This is how I would like to customize this situation so that, you know, it represents us as a family. And so they're not being difficult. They're usually just exercising their natural style and wanting to customize or humanize or personalize something about their care. And the system that favors sameness and standard care and usual care and efficiencies doesn't like that. But too bad.
Mm-hmm. Well, when we think about a resident coming into long-term care, and my whole philosophy is about making it relational, not transactional. Because this is the place that the person's going to live for the rest of their life. And the average length of stay is 18 months. Mm-hmm. An average long-term care home has half of their residents who leave every year primarily through death. So going into that, sometimes families have expectations that their loved one's going to get better or their loved one's going to stay the same. And not have, or the decline in the resident gets blamed on, well, it's because they're living in a nursing home now, as an example. Yeah. So if you were there at that long-term care home or assisted living memory care on admission day, what would you advise the staff in how they can open this conversation about the palliative approach?
Yeah, again, I probably wouldn't use the P word. I would probably say, how about we talk about the illness that landed your loved one here at our front door? How much do you understand about the circumstances or the health challenges that your loved one has that required them to come to long-term care? Let's talk about that. What's your understanding of this person's illness? What's your understanding of the decline you were seeing at home or the increase in their needs? Did you understand how that connected with their underlying illness or illnesses? Did you ever ask anyone before you came here what to expect going forward with this particular condition? And what did they tell you? And if they hadn't discussed that with you, is that something that you would like to talk about today? Because it can really help you give you a roadmap or a guidebook or an overarching storyline of what we're likely to expect here while your loved one lives here in long-term care. I mean, that's the kind of conversation I would have instead of saying, look, from the front door here, we are going to provide a palliative approach, and this is what it means, because most people will see that as, oh, you're giving up on my loved one. Oh, you're not going to provide them active care. Oh, are you telling me the person's actively dying? So you end up having to untangle so much of that. I think I would just start by saying, let's get on the same page here. I wouldn't say it like that, but how about we review the issues that brought your loved one here and talk about what we can expect going forward.
If you'd like to learn more about the work that I do in providing staff training, family training, or if you're also looking to redesign your admission process, you can find me at deborahbakhti.com. And you can email me at deborah@deborahbakhti.com, and all that information will be in the show notes. Those questions are great because they're questions, and you're creating the space for the individual to be able to share, and you're learning so much through that level of curiosity versus, as you were saying, it's not about telling them that this is how things are going to work. And when you think about if you were with the family, would there be a different approach you would take with the family coming in? Again, assuming that they know very little about and don't want to talk about the P word. How to be able to prepare them and how to best manage their expectations now that their loved one's in long-term care.
Yeah. So, you know, the unfortunate thing is that people in the staff at long-term care, the patient and the family, are set up by the neglect to have these kinds of conversations before they ever got there. Certainly the decline does not start at the door. It started prior to the person coming in, wherever they were in the community, at home, in the hospital, in a retirement home. It is because we don't have these conversations earlier that sometimes we're left having them when there's this big change happening, a transition, like from one care setting to another. So coming into long-term care is definitely very anxiety provoking and guilt ridden and scary for patients and families. And so I think we need to take that into consideration. I think that we can walk two roads with families. I think we can explain to them we're hoping that their loved one gets the care that they need, that we make them the best that they can be, that they have some restorative function, perhaps, now that they're in this care setting, that some people have an improvement and a honeymoon period because they're getting the medications routinely and they're getting the type of care that they need. But at the same time, we want to plan for the natural changes that we're going to see with this underlying Alzheimer's or neurodegenerative illness, Parkinson's, lung conditions, heart conditions, cancers, that they have a pattern to them. So we can both hope for the very best and plan for the natural changes that are going to happen so that the expectations match the reality of the illness.
And that's one of the things I think is many great parts of your book and providing some education, because most people have not been a part of that journey of through palliative and then end of life and knowing what to expect. Mm-hmm. That there mm-hmm. are some predictable aspects to it, although everyone is different.
Yeah.
And part of that is accepting the brutal reality that this mm-hmm. is what is happening. And part of that accepting can be a bit challenging.
Yeah. And, you know, dying is a physiologic process. It is a very natural stage of the human condition. It doesn't start the minutes before death. It is a chapter in life. And if people don't, if they haven't seen it before, or if they don't recognize it because of the busyness of worrying about the day-to-day decline that's happening or the month-to-month decline, we miss the opportunity to harness the time that this chapter provides us. Dying doesn't normally happen overnight. It's not a light switch. It is a process that happens usually over some months, and then some weeks, and then some days, and then some hours. And if you don't know what to expect, then you're going to see that as one crisis after the other. And that's the busy noise I'm talking about, sending someone to the ER or for hospital admission outside of long-term care, when really this was just a normal decline. The appetite going down, fatigue, and the change in functional status, this is all a normal part of dying.
And what's interesting about that is, part of the process is to ask the family so that it's in the residence binder what the funeral arrangements will be. And mm-hmm. some families do resist that, but I remember being asked that question and which funeral home and that type of thing. But there wasn't the question around, how will we communicate when we start to see the signs?
Yeah.
And even though Ty lived in long-term care for 4 years, when I got the phone call on the Monday morning to say, you need to get here, he became unconscious in the middle of the night. Mm. I don't recall there being any kind of warning conversations. And so it was expected, but not expected.
Yeah, it's like it's the elephant in the room, right? That no one's talking about. And that's so hard, because for you then, what should have been and could have been an expected death over a 4-year period, where there's time for you to begin to grieve and adjust and steel yourself for a major loss that's going to come at some point, you are more encouraged to avoid that stuff and to just go about this new routine, and as if there isn't going to be an end point. And so we turned an expected death into a sudden death experience for you, Deb. And that's much harder to deal with than, preparing over time. Like, part of you was probably preparing, but it was a covert operation. And then when you get that call, it's like a knife in your heart. And I bet if you reflect on Ty's illness journey, there was probably a lot of signs that he was declining before that night, that there were changes.
Yes. And I think going back to the conversation about how as a disease progresses, and I almost envision it like different plateaus, or they don't mm-hmm. fully recover from whatever last episode. Mm-hmm. But then to look at it from a predictive standpoint, I know that it's not as easy as that. But to your point of in that emotional preparation, and as well, I don't recall having conversations with the staff to say, listen, I'm a person who, wants to have the information, want to be prepared. Mm-hmm. We've got 2 young kids. They keep asking me what's going on. Mm-hmm. To have that conversation, yeah. to say, mm-hmm. whatever it is, or maybe some other families that would say, I don't want to know. I don't want to know mm-hmm. until the day comes. But I think we can do more to support staff and families And going back to those questions that you shared, which I'm going to summarize and put in the show notes because that's a handout sheet for people. Mm-hmm. But to be able to say, you know, this is what is going to happen at some point. Let's agree while we have the mental and emotional capacity, how mm-hmm. we're going to engage in conversation. Because I do think sometimes staff are reluctant, afraid, they don't want to upset the family, but we're making assumptions mm-hmm. that the family won't want to have that conversation.
Yeah, I think that you're right. It is our duty to invite people to have information, but it's not our duty to force people. So we have to be very sensitive to where people are at with wanting and being ready for information, but we shouldn't decide that for people. So we need to ask people or let people know, you know, we have cared for people like this before, maybe not exactly your loved one, but we have a general ideas about the future and what to expect. And there's no question that's too big or too scary for us. We have information if you're the kind of person who likes to have information, or if you're the kind of person who likes to look into the future. We do have a general sense of what to expect here. And you know, even though, especially with illnesses that are more rare, perhaps we can't predict the exact way things are going to go, but I can tell you what dying looks like for all people underneath whatever illness, whether it is a common illness or a unique illness. We may not know exactly from week to week what it's going to look like, but we can tell you what dying starts looking like with any illness.
Mm-hmm. Well, that I recommend, and we'll put your social, your Instagram and LinkedIn in the show notes. Mm-hmm. Because what I find, you have the ability, and I see this on your Instagram reels, to be compassionate, approachable, and pragmatic all at the same time.
Well, you know, it's very funny because on TikTok, well, thank you for that, Deb, but on TikTok, a bunch of people, well, they say the darndest things. So mm-hmm. they say some horrible things, some amazing things, and everything in between. But I had a couple of people refer to me as the Mr. Rogers of palliative care. And it just reminded me of when you said, when you described me, I should have a cardigan, you know, Mr. Rogers,
yes,
right?
Yes.
I should have a cardigan on and, you know, do it up. And it feels very square to me, but pragmatic and, you know, just like the person next door. That's how I speak. Mm-hmm. Because I care for people in their homes. And the team that I work with is the family. And in every care setting, our team is the family. And so we know that, that they're part of our healthcare team. And so we can't be fanciful. We have to meet them where they're at. And, you know, it's just what I've gotten used to is really, I guess, this very down to earth, for lack of better words, way of communicating about these things. There's no reason to make it sophisticated.
No. And in the other section in your book that I had marked was around the inner crew, and the term that you use to refer to the family or friends or people that are in that circle. And you say, the inner crew's needs are often overlooked. Family members often feel guilty drawing attention to their own needs, since they feel that the patient's needs should be the priority. After caring for a patient for a long time, family members have told me, I lost my sense of me. And mm-hmm. highlighted that, reflected on that. Certainly that was my experience and families that mm-hmm. I've talked to, because we feel like it's almost like the survivor's guilt. We're not the one mm-hmm. with the condition. And mm-hmm. yet the level of caregiver stress and anxiety and worry and guilt and fear. And it feels like with the work that you do, you bring the family and the family crew mm-hmm. into the conversation mm-hmm. and helping them to feel seen and heard and appreciated is mm-hmm. only going to ripple out in the level of care within that community.
Yeah. Yeah, I can tell you in medical school, and I don't think it's changed, we really do not get taught how to truly integrate caregivers and families or inner crews, the informal care team, into anything that we do. I mean, I would say we're better now at putting a token, you know, patient or family representative on committees and things like that. But when it comes to the day-to-day care of someone, that it is a team sport. They are a unit of care, selfishly in people's homes. I pay attention to families because it is make it or break it. They are the linchpin in the whole entire system in the home. If they're not well, there's no way we'll be able to care for this person at home. But unselfishly, they are also having a parallel illness experience. So they're having to support their loved ones. So they deserve all the information that the patient gets. But they're also having their own illness experience because it's a huge change. Their role as wife or daughter or son or neighbor has changed. They have to readjust their own life to accommodate this role that they're in. And they're preparing for a major loss. And so it has implications for their own mental health, their own grief, their own practical decisions that they have to make about work and finances. And it's life altering for the inner crew. And so they're very much part of the person's illness, but they have their own stuff going on and they will survive. And the quality of their health in that bereavement stage and their and further on is reflected in the experience they have while they're in those caregiver roles. So it's really important to pay attention to families at the inner crew. We name it the inner crew because there's so many different ways people patchwork together people around them when they're ill. Sometimes it's just out of convenience. Someone lives in the same house you live in, or it could be you have no one who lives in your house, so it becomes your neighbors or friends or whatever it is. And not everyone's blood family is their inner crew. So we had to come up with some term that, you know, encompassed everyone.
Mm-hmm. I have a family member that is has a life-changing diagnosis and is waiting for a major procedure. And his spouse said to me, that they've been directed by the doctors. He's got the team. He's got all the specialists, all of the support. You need to find your support team as the spouse because you don't have anyone supporting you as you're supporting him.
Mm-hmm.
And it really landed for me in my role as a family member, who else and what kind of supports, and to actually use your book, Hope for the Best, Plan for the Rest, as a support tool for what they're going to be going through for the next 6 to 9 months plus.
Yeah, I think that whoever said that, like, you know, acknowledged and shone a light on the caregiver, that you also deserve and have the right to have support and a care team around you, did a great thing by doing that. I think one step further would be that I would shine a mirror back on that person and say that doctor is part of your support team as well, that the caregivers or the inner crew doesn't just find their own separate, you know, support team. There might be some people outside of the patient support team for sure, like the person's own family doctor would be important, but they shouldn't have to go find a completely separate team of healthcare providers. Maybe an informal team that looks different than the patient's team. But, you know, I think we all have to see caregivers as part of our responsibility when we have a patient.
Yeah. Yeah. Good point. I will pass that on to them.
Don't reference me.
I will not. Yeah. We won't reference this.
Yeah.
Just before we wrap up, I would love for you to share the work that you're doing with the Waiting Room Revolution.
Yeah, well, thank you for asking. The Waiting Room Revolution is a social movement. If you had asked me, you know, when I was younger, are you going to start a social movement one day? I would have said, I don't even know what you're talking about. And I'm still not 100% sure I fully understand. But CN and I, we're starting a social movement called the Waiting Room Revolution. It's an all hands on deck, citizen facing, not just an awareness campaign, but shouting from the top of our lungs as much as we can that, you know, the citizens of the world, patients and families, have a right to a lot more than they know they have a right to, and that they could fundamentally improve their illness experience and illness journey if we gave them a fighting chance. They may not be able to change the underlying condition, but we certainly can make the illness experience better. So the Waiting Room Revolution has a website. We have the book that you've been reading from. We have podcasts, and I recommend season one. It's the heart of our podcast. We have multiple social media platforms. We have speaking engagements. Deb, you'll be one of the first to know that we're coming out with a workbook that's going to supplement the book that you're holding. We're coming out with a course. And all of this is for citizens, and healthcare providers can take it too, but it's really meant for the public, and it's meant for the beginning of an illness journey so that the entire illness journey is improved and represents you as a person, that you can recognize yourself in your own illness journey and not be sanitized to a patient that doesn't recognize themselves and a caregiver that feels ignored. That's what we're up to. And so welcome to our revolution, Deb, by inviting me onto your podcast and reading the book and taking it to heart and sharing it with others. You are part of our social movement, and every person in this movement is an important piece so that we can all force the system to have to change and not just label us difficult, but we are entitled to a very humanized care experience.
That's fantastic. This hope for the best, plan for the rest, a must read, families that have loved ones in seniors care. And I also think, Dr. Sammy, this is a great book for people who work in seniors care, mm-hmm. and can also be a resource that they can have to make available to families should they be interested in understanding the seven keys for navigating a life-changing diagnosis. This work is just fantastic. Thank you so much for making the time to come on the Empathy Exchange. It was great chatting mm-hmm. with you. We'll make sure that all of your information's in the show notes so that people can find all the great resources that you have.
Oh, I really appreciate that, Deb. I'm so grateful to be invited. And thank you for all the work that you're doing with the Empathy Exchange and sharing your own personal experience with the world. They will benefit from learning from you.
Thank you so much. Mm-hmm. And remember, there's power in your presence. So make your presence matter.